From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour, we'll discuss the obstacles facing the next generation of farmers. We'll discuss the challenges of access to land, the availability of finance and credit, creating new markets, and implementing the 2008 Farm Bill. My guests are Neil Hamilton and Matt Russell from Drake Law School's Agriculture Law Center. Then in our second half hour, we'll find out about cover crops and how they benefit land sustainability. We'll talk with Tom Casper of the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment and Jerry Neal of the Leopold Center Ecology Initiative. The challenges for Old MacDonald in the year 2010. After this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we examine what it takes to be a farmer in the year 2010 and beyond. Our discussion prompted by a couple of ag-related events in the news. Tomorrow, the first joint workshops on agriculture by regulators at the U.S. Justice and Agriculture Departments is expected to give farmers, lobbyists, executives, and academics a strong indication of where the Obama administration stands on consolidation in agriculture. In another ag-related event, last week the focus of a two-day forum in Washington, D.C., sponsored by Drake University's Agricultural Law Center, looked at how to help create America's next generation of farmers. So today we're examining the challenges for Old MacDonald in 2010 and the years beyond. Joining us first of all from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines, Neil Hamilton, director of Drake Law School's Agricultural Law Center, and Matt Russell, who is also at the Agricultural Law Center. He is a food policy project coordinator. Good afternoon to you, Neil Hamilton and Matt Russell.
Hello, Ben. Good to be on your show.
Great to have you with us this afternoon, Neil and Matt. Let's focus first on last week's conference, focused on creating America's next generation of farmers. What was the consensus here? What will be most crucial to helping the next generation of farmers come along?
Well, I think, Ben, the consensus, there were several. One is certainly a belief that we need more farmers and new farmers, and that there are some wonderful opportunities and demand. But at the same time, we certainly heard a fair amount of a consensus about some of the challenges they face, the lack of capital to invest, the availability of land, the access to credit and finance. But I think I was certainly heartened with the speakers in terms of the optimism and the energy and the excitement that a lot of people who are looking for futures in agriculture really bring to the table.
Mm-hmm. Because when we talk about future in agriculture, people aren't thinking typically of as a future, a career. Tell us now about the current demographic of a typical farmer in the United States. That's quite old these days, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly the average age of farmers continues to drift up. But I think in addition to the age of the farmers who are there, we also have this phenomena of the concentration of land into the hands of older landowners, many of whom are widows. And so you have this incredible kind of compression in land, which means that you both have an increase in absentee ownership, and we're going to have a significant amount of land change hands. And so for a number of reasons, the nation, I think, is needing and looking for who those next generation of farmers and landowners and land stewards are going to be.
Mm-hmm. And I would also add that probably at least in a generation, if not two or three generations, what's interesting right now demographically is you have a number of very bright young people who are intrigued and excited and willing, as one of our participants said, she's voting with her life. These are people really dedicated and interested and excited about opportunities in agriculture, and that's an exciting change as well.
And many of those people, in fact, aren't kids who grew up on farms. I think in Iowa, when we think about kind of the next generation of farming, it's natural we would look to those sons and daughters who grew up on the farm who want to come back, and which is certainly an important component. But I think that there's a significant movement underfoot around the country in connection whether it's local foods or healthy foods or sustainability. But you have a lot of young people who are interested in being involved in the food system in some way, and in many ways that may involve being farmers and stewarding some land. Mm-hmm. The farms may take a little different shape or size, but they're farmers.
Mm-hmm. So you could have someone very excited about farming, currently maybe a city dweller, but someone who wants to get out on a farm. And you mentioned one of the obstacles would be access to land. How big is that problem? How do we address that?
Well, certainly, you know, the access to land issue, I mean, some people who hear that may say, well, I don't see any problem with access to land. If you have enough money to buy it, there's plenty of land available on the market. But, you know, the access to land is also tied into the issue of credit or capital or what people can bring. I think part of the issue with access to land is that as you have this generation of landowners who at some point are going to, you know, need to have their land transition to someone else, how do we get them to think about succession or transition or the opportunities to help bring a young farmer in with them? In addition, you know, there's also a fair amount of land that's owned by what you might describe as institutional owners, churches, universities, land trusts, other entities who, in fact, if they thought about how they use their land and whether their land may, in fact, be available to perhaps provide an opportunity for a new family, a new farmer to come onto the land, how they could do that.
Mm-hmm. How has Washington, the federal government, been involved here? Is there any support to President Obama trying to promote small-scale new agriculture ventures?
Well, I think that's still certainly a work in progress. You know, the Secretary Vilsack was at the conference, was in fact our kickoff speaker, and put helping create and support new farmers in the context of their efforts to help revitalize rural America. A number of things that the president has made a priority, such as you know, healthy food and even job creation, are really tied to how we might think about opportunities for farmers. And so the administration is interested. Part of the forum was to both give them a place to share some of those commitments, but also to help generate some of the evidence of the interest on the part of other parts of society and the political spectrum that these are important issues.
We hear a lot about conservation programs in agriculture, green agriculture. What role, how does that fit into the challenges and creating new farmers for the next generations?
Well, that actually ties into your previous question, and that is, I think we're seeing a development across all of the agencies, the NRCS and the FSA and rural development, really trying to work together so that those programs work for new and beginning farmers and work for new and beginning farmers in evolving ways, not just in the traditional, you know, ever-increasing 340-acre average farm in Iowa, but other opportunities too. And those conservation programs are key. You know, we're in our sixth year of Patrick Stanley and I of having our own farm, and the conservation programs have been key in helping us develop our farm. How do I want to say it? We've set our goals and then looked to federal programs to help us reach our goals, and the conservation programs have done that really well, versus simply looking to the federal programs, what are the goals that they'll pay for.
Yeah, and on that
so it's a good evolution.
And on that issue of, you know, how Washington is involved, you know, if you consider Congress and the 2008 Farm Bill to be a major component of Washington's involvement, you know, part of the forum wasn't just to look forward as to what more can we do, but also to look back a little bit and say, well, what did we achieve in 2008 and how are those programs being implemented? And there were a number of significant new farmer-related initiatives in the 2008 Farm Bill, and including you know, some targeted financing related to conservation programs for beginning farmers, as well as another program that's still kind of yet to be implemented, but it's a transition period for people coming out of the CRP, or the Conservation Reserve Program, to help make their land available to new farmers.
Neil Hamilton and Matt Russell, my guests from Drake Law School's Agricultural Law Center. If you'd like to join our conversation, do you work in agriculture? Are you a farmer? What do you think needs to happen to create the next generation of farmers? What are your thoughts? 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. For years, farmers have had complaints that big corporations are choking out smaller players. I wonder, what with the dominance of corporate farming, can new farmers thrive in the current market?
Well, certainly, the issue of the structure of agriculture and questions of concentration is much in the news because of what's going to happen in Ankeny tomorrow and initiating the Department of Justice and USDA's new series to look at these issues. But I think on the question of how that relates to new farmers, one of the things that I think you have to recognize that new farmers bring to the table is the ability to be nimble, flexible, innovative, to take advantage of niches and market opportunities. And, as any system, and agriculture production certainly being one of them, becomes larger and more concentrated, it can also become a little bit more, or less flexible. And so it creates a vacuum behind it. And in many ways, I think a lot of the opportunities in America's food system for new farmers are, in fact, those opportunities that the dominant agriculture system isn't necessarily either able to address or willing to address or wants to, or perhaps doesn't even see them.
Can you give us an example of an emerging opportunity?
Well, certainly. The significant growth in farmers' markets across the country is one of the major developments within American agriculture. And people may say, well, farmers' markets, it's only a couple percent of America's food system.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at it from the standpoint of you being a farmer and an opportunity to, in fact, become involved in farming, find a market that has relatively low obstacles or barriers to entry in terms of cost and that can be valuable, farmers' markets are important. One of our speakers was the director of the farmers markets in Washington, D.C., and presented some pretty amazing information concerning the incomes that farmers are receiving. And so that's just one example of those type of markets that I think operate outside of what you might describe as more of a traditional agricultural structure.
Quickly, before we have to take a break, can a person now with a couple hundred acres sell on farmers markets and create an income that will support a family?
I think you can do that with a couple acres or a dozen acres. It doesn't take a couple hundred. In fact, you probably don't find very many people with a couple hundred acres. But Matt certainly can speak to that because farmers markets are a significant part of their farm's structure.
Okay, we'll have to address that when we come back. We're talking with Neil Hamilton and Matt Russell of Drake Law School's Agricultural Law Center. And also when we come back, we'll talk about this significant meeting tomorrow in Ankeny. Regulators at the U.S. Justice and Agriculture Departments tomorrow in Ankeny. We'll tell you about that when we come back. Your thoughts on the future of farming, 1-866-780-9100. Your questions, 1-866-780-9100, or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in 60 seconds. We're talking about challenges, obstacles, and opportunities for farmers in the year 2010 and beyond. My guests, Neil Hamilton and Matt Russell of Drake Law School's Agricultural Law Center. Matt, I wanted to talk to you quickly before we move on to this Ankeny meeting to talk about that. You and your partner have a 110-acre farm near Lacona. I think you purchased that a few years ago. So you're saying the emerging farmers market trend and the fact that farmers can go right to these markets, get a nice margin on what they're selling, allows an emerging opportunity here for farmers.
Yeah, it's really a classic both and not either or situation. This is we know what the trends in commodity agriculture are, and they're for bigger and more consolidation and fewer opportunities for new people entering. But the exciting thing is that that's not all that's happening, and consumers are saying that while they still go to the grocery store and they still buy a lot of what they've always been buying, they're wanting something else as well. And so that's where there's opportunities for people to build a relationship with these consumers and kind of be outside of or beyond the traditional commodity conventional market exchange. So we have both, and we can continue to develop opportunities for the for bigger commodity farms, but now there's these new opportunities for what I call relational marketing, where we go out and we develop a relationship with our customers. Most of them are consumers, but some of them are institutions or restaurants. But we develop the relationship, and then we find out what they need and what they want, and we grow that for them.
Okay, let's talk about this workshop tomorrow in Ankeny, the first joint workshops on agriculture by regulators at the U.S. Justice and Agriculture Departments. Tomorrow in Ankeny, expected to give farmers, lobbyists, executives, and academics a strong indication of where the Obama administration stands on consolidation in agriculture. Among those attending, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. And so what prompted these meetings? The longstanding complaints that big corporations are choking out smaller players?
Well, I think that, you know, if you want to know what prompted the meetings, we held an election not long ago, and we had a change in administration, and I think that the president and the new secretary, these were issues that they believe are legitimate and need to be addressed. And so, you know, I think the news that is going to come out of this is in part the fact that it's happening. That the Department of Justice in particular is, you know, interested in learning more and having a little bit more of a national conversation about issues of consolidation and competition and how the antitrust laws are working or aren't, and hearing from the field. Now, your opening comment said you were going to have some indication or a strong indication of how the administration feels. Personally, I don't know that you're going to see that. I mean, the indication is the fact that the forums are happening. I think the Department of Justice and USDA are looking at them as a way to gather input and information and to hear from people. And if anything, one of the questions is going to be how they may be able to manage the expectations that may have been created on the part of people who are heartened by the fact that this is going to happen. And conversely, how they may manage the fears or the worries on the part of the people who see that this is going to happen and wonder what the other shoe might be, if, in fact, there is another shoe and if it drops.
Mm-hmm. What is your opinion, the two of you, on the real purpose of this meeting? I know at this point the stated purpose is listening, but political theater or a first step toward legal action?
Well, I think that it does a disservice to call it political theater. I mean, I think that you have to take them that they're sincere, and certainly the USDA and Department of Justice people we visited with, they are. But at the same time, I don't know that they know, okay, well, we're going to do this, and then we already know we're going to take these three steps that follow on. They want to give the public an opportunity to be heard. They want to gather that information, and then, you know, they'll have to take it back. You know, the Department of Justice, as it relates to antitrust, you know, this isn't a legislative forum in which they're saying, okay, well, guys, you know, should we have some type of new piece of legislation? You know, the Department of Justice looks at questions as to whether or not there are activities that violate the law that need to be investigated, whether there may be potential litigation or enforcement actions. And so, you know, I don't know that you're going to have anything that shows up at a forum that would necessarily lead to that. Then, okay, this is the next thing that has to happen because we heard somebody talk about it for 2 minutes in Ankeny on the 12th of March.
Okay, let's go to callers. We have about 5 minutes left in our discussion with the two of you. Let's try to squeeze in at least a couple callers. Greg is joining us from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, please. What is your question or comment?
Well, I went to the county Republican convention, and they only had one plank on agriculture, so that tells you a lot. But what I want to discuss is what I call the Walmart syndrome, and that is you have giant entities that generate so much tax revenue paying into the government at all levels. Why should they care about the small guys, the small businesses, the small farmers, et cetera, et cetera? And this syndrome is ruining the country.
Okay, let's get a reaction to that, Greg. Good point. So we're up against forces that many people see as insurmountable.
Yeah. I think Greg's point to something that we see every day on our farm, and that is that people are reacting to the market in many ways, and many people don't like what Walmart is doing. They're looking for other places where they can buy things and other things that they can buy that Walmart doesn't have. So one of the things that's happening is that folks are creating a market for new products and for new farms, and we're certainly trying to tap into that.
It's important to remember, though, that even, you know, whatever your concerns about Walmart may be, ultimately Walmart is responding to consumers. And, in fact, Walmart has become a major seller of organic food and even has a campaign underway in which they say they're identifying local farms. Now, that may well raise suspicions on the part of people, but if there are significant issues involved in terms of either the quality of the food or other things that consumers are looking for, large companies aren't necessarily immune from them, particularly if they see markets perhaps disappearing on them.
Okay, Hal is joining us from New Sharon. Hi, Hal.
Hi, my name's Holly Everett, also known as Hal. I've been doing the farmers markets for about 7 years, and I recently started renting from my uncle about 100 acres. One of the things I see with the difference between supplying to large entities like Walmart is they really do downplay the amount of money that they're willing to give a farmer for quality food versus the amount of energy and effort that's expended. They want market value prices with above value for the consumer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a small entity person who doesn't, well, say, for instance, rent or hire a lot of people to do the work, you know, that's your own personal labor that you're having to undervalue and sell them at a discount. I don't see how Walmart, even though it's responding to the organic market, can actually be very sustainable for a farmer to sell to unless they hire people for below wages. And how is that considered contributing to the whole overall economy if you're having to underpay people because Walmart underpays you? Secondly, I find that one of the biggest obstacles is the USDA itself. They actually have a certain amount of crop acres you're supposed to have. And if you've had a history of these crop acres, you are unable to take those crop acres out to put into vegetables.
Okay.
That's sort of impeding this farmer's market issue. And thirdly,
quickly,
it's very difficult for the young farmer to actually get financing, especially if they're just planning on renting, which is one of the initial young farmers' problems. And also as how to transition from the elderly who oftentimes either refuse to quit farming or refuse to give a below value for the starting out farmer.
Hal, you put a lot of those issues right in a nutshell for us. Let's get a quick response. We only have about a minute left. Who wants to tackle that in the final minute?
Well, certainly part of the purpose of the forum and one of the things that came out of it was hearing from different people within USDA that they recognize that there are more that they can do in terms of making their programs accessible to small farmers and young farmers and looking for ways to do that. And, you know, the market concentration issues certainly are legitimate. And that's, again, one of the reasons why many people are looking for farmers markets and other forms of markets that give them an opportunity to claim a larger share of the food dollar.
Okay, very good. We'll have to leave it there for this half hour. We continue talking about agriculture in the next half hour. But I want to thank our guests, Neil Hamilton, director of Drake Law School's Agricultural Law Center, Matt Russell, a food policy project coordinator with that law center. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
And coming up, we find out about cover crops and how they benefit land sustainability. We'll talk with Tom Casper, the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment, and also Jerry Neal of the Leopold Center Ecology Initiative. That's when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. So glad you could be with us this noon hour on The Exchange. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at this time, in a special live broadcast of The Exchange from Iowa City's downtown Java House, we look at the emergence of the Tea Party as a grassroots organization. We'll talk with Iowa Tea Party organizers, ask what they want, how they view their movement, and how they plan to influence politics in the state as well as in the country. A special edition of The Exchange. Going to be broadcasting live from Iowa City's downtown Java House tomorrow, Friday, beginning at noon. Today we're talking about what it takes to be a farmer in the year 2010 and beyond, also how the landscape is changing for those who work in agriculture. Now we want to turn to a different facet of developments in ag. If turnout at the annual workshop of the Midwest Cover Crops Council's conference earlier this month in Ames is any indication, the use of cover crops could be on the rise. What exactly are cover crops, you may be asking yourself, and how can they benefit land sustainability? Two of the questions we'll explore now with my guests. Joining us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames, Tom Casper is with the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment, and Jerry Neal is with the Leopold Center Ecology Initiative. Good afternoon to you, Tom and Jerry from Ames.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Ben. Nice to be here.
Great to have you with us. Who wants to tell us, get us up to speed? For those of us who don't know, remind us, what are cover crops? Let's start there.
I can start with
that
Jerry.
One. Mm-hmm.
We host, there's a lot of interest in this right now because we hosted here in Iowa the third annual meeting of the Midwest Cover Crops Council. And that's 11 states and provinces, a lot of people that are working on what cover crops are and how you use them. Everybody in that group kind of shares one overall vision. They're thinking about green lands and blue waters, mm-hmm. but they're focused primarily on this idea of getting more living cover on the ground. So when we're in Iowa, because of the predominance of the corn soybean, we tend to think if somebody says cover crop, you think of it pretty much as what do I plant, you know, do between planting and harvesting?
Mm-hmm.
How do I cover that brown soil?
So we don't just have the soil and the old corn stalk sticking out.
Right. So you've got something else there. But, you know, cover crops actually have a very wide range of uses, and they have a very wide range of functions. And so that's going to differ from farm to farm and depending on what type of operation people have. And the cover crops can provide all kinds of uses. So they can extend rotations, and they can provide forages, for example. Improve carbon sequestration, provide nutrients, improve infiltration, reduce runoff. The benefits are so many that we're just kind of determined that we're going to figure out how to make this work for the folks in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. What is the history of using cover crops? Did we get away from this as we got more industrialized with our agriculture? Did we used to always use cover crops and then got away from it, or is this new?
Well, that's kind of hard to say. To some extent, that's true. In the old days, we used to grow more legumes to produce nitrogen for our crops like corn or wheat. And in the years when we had wheat, or in Iowa we grew a lot of oats, it was pretty common to have a cover crop following those. In a lot of cases, it was alfalfa that was planted with the oats in the spring and then grew after the harvest. Red clover was another one.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that was a lot more prevalent back in the 40s, even as late as the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Most of us aren't chemists, but can you tell us what's happening in terms of the soil's fertility when we use a cover crop? What is its value is in that sense?
I'm definitely going to let Tom grab this one. He's giving me the look now.
Right.
Well, it's mainly, it does work to recycle a lot of different nutrients, but the one that we talk about primarily is nitrogen. And people tend to think that nitrogen is just controlled by how much fertilizer we apply or don't apply, and we're usually applying that for corn, but really, we get a lot of nitrogen just from the decomposition of organic matter in our soil. So, in other words, our soils are producing nitrogen all year long. And we are only growing crops for about 5 months of the year. So we have a seven-month period where we still have a lot of nitrogen in the soil, and we're getting a lot of rainfall, or in this year, a lot of snowfall, and that water is moving down through the soil and washing that nitrogen away. By having a cover crop there, you have a plant that can take up the nitrogen, incorporate it into its roots and shoots, and then later when that decomposes, it'll become available for a crop somewhere down the road in future years.
You just had this annual workshop of the Midwest Cover Crops Council Conference. A rise in interest, was that measurable?
Yes, it was. In fact, I'd say almost half of the attendees on our major day were farmers. Mm-hmm. And there are so many farmers out there that are experimenting with this. Everybody, it's not just organic farmers, but conventional farmers, but people are quite scattered. One of the things that we're going to try to do is to create, capture some of those stories, because the best thing we can do now, we have research that's happening, but the best thing that we can do now is help farmers share stories with each other about what has worked and probably more importantly, what has not worked. Okay. A lot of the farmers that were at our conference meeting were there to hear. We had three very different farmers there telling their stories of how they've done this and what the trade-offs are. And those kind of learning lessons are one of the things that we're very interested in capturing and then sharing back out so that people have, if you're interested, you've got somebody that's within your area or maybe your region that can say, ooh, tried this, tried that, this didn't work, I had to make these changes.
Okay.
The management pieces are different, and so there's a learning curve with the management.
Well, let's reach out right now before we continue with our discussion and see if there are listeners out there using cover crops. Perhaps it's an experiment right now. Does it make sense for you? What is your experience? What has worked with cover crops? What has not? What questions do you have? Exchange listeners, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. So typically, what would be a reason that a cover crop would not work?
Well, this year would have probably been an example of when it would have been difficult to get a cover crop in because of late harvest. It's one of those things that it's not going to be a practice you're just going to insert into your cropping system without some changes. And for instance, the farmers that we had at the conference and the people there that I talked to, they are using techniques of they're having somebody help them with planting cover crops while they continue to harvest, or they're finding ways to seed the cover crops before harvest to get around that problem of time and time management, you know, in the fall when they're busy with harvest and other things.
Here's an email that just came in. Could your guest comment on the use of cover crops as so-called trap crops to attract pests away from the crop of value? Toward what the pest sees as a more favorable habitat. The anonymous emailer says, I have a neighbor who has educated me somewhat on this process.
Well, I don't have any experience with that myself. Another scientist that I work with, Jeremy Singer, has been involved in a study with some entomology people at Iowa State where they've sort of shown the opposite, that the cover crop has attracted beneficial insects that then preyed on soybean aphids was one of the pests that they were looking at. So, and I'm sure that that can work both ways, attract pests away or attract beneficial insects to help control those pests.
Jerry Neal, you mentioned that there were several stories you heard from farmers using cover crops during this conference. What's a story that stands out for you from that conference with perhaps a lesson for us all?
Well, it's that the cover crop can fit, has a lot of flexibility to fit any number of sizes and types of operations. I think that sometimes we feel like there's just absolutely no way that we could ever get a cover crop into corn, soybean. And it is challenging because we didn't pick those corn and soybeans to be raised with cover crops. But you know, we listened to a farmer who does, is Steve Berger 1,000 acres? But 1,000 acre operation, and he's made this work for a number of years. And so I think it's an interesting lesson to know that it can be done. And it can be done on a lot of different sizes and types of farm operations. It's very common when you're in the vegetable growers, and then also more common in the organic folks because they're required to have certain types of rotations in place and they're looking at other forms of fertility, a whole number of things. But I think that we all are moving towards this idea of how do we get healthier soil? How do we get better water infiltration? And we're going to need that when we start looking at what's happening with weather changes, greater precipitation events. This is going to be very important. And so for me, it was really encouraging to have, you know, just your normal, regular farmer who was able to say, hey, a little creativity here, and I can make that work. I tweaked this. I changed that. And so that was what I found the best part about it, I think.
You're saying this is a long-term investment in the soil, but is it an immediate economic return? Should a farmer be looking at it that way as well?
Well, it's unless you're a cattle producer and you have a great use grazing, or you're harvesting the cover crop for forage or green chop, it's not an immediate economic return. It's something that is going to improve your soil over time and eventually reduce in, I'd say, you know, less variable crop yields of your main grain crops. So, no, it's not a short-term investment. But a lot of things we do in agriculture are not short-term investments.
Okay.
Preventing erosion is a long-term investment, but it has definite impacts on yield.
Number of callers want to join our conversation. First up is Brian from Hampton. Hi, Brian. Welcome to The Exchange. Brian, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to share an experience, and this relates to what your guests were just talking about, having livestock. We've had great success in Franklin County with winter rye, and we plant that immediately after chopping corn for silage. And then in the spring, we cut that winter rye and we ensile that as well as a forage crop. And then we plant a second crop, a double crop soybeans after that winter rye. We've had great success.
How many years have you been doing this, Brian?
Oh, for about 5 years now. But I grew up in Waverly, and my dad did the same thing years and years ago. And he planted winter rye, and then he would green chop that in the spring for dairy cattle before the cows could go out in the pasture. And then he would plant corn again after chopping the rye or even cutting the rye for hay. So it works great in our rotation, and we're getting an economic return, obviously, because we're feeding cattle. But gives us three crops in 2 years. And also, I think that rye is a great weed suppressant. I think there's been a bunch of research done in Iowa State, actually, that something about the rye really suppresses weeds. And when we plant soybeans into that rye, after we cut the rye in about June, first couple weeks of June, there are no weeds there. So it's been a great system for us, helping the soil and also giving us some more return per acre of land.
Okay, Brian, thank you for that reaction from Jerry and Tom. That's a great experience.
Yeah, it sure is, and that's one of the applications that we'd sort of call a no-brainer, that we are continuing to do research on corn silage and winter rye to try to document some of the soil health or soil quality benefits, but it's no doubt you can certainly provide a good quality feed for cattle and it fits in well with the whole manure silage operation.
Yeah, and I would say Brian's definitely on top of his game here. You know, he's thinking about that multiple year net profitability and really done a fine job. So great to hear from you, Brian. Good work.
Let's mention there is a cost sharing program. This is an incentive. Tell us about that.
Well, I can make what little I know is I know that NRCS is actually offering some cost share dollars for cover crops, and the amount is $60 an acre, which I believe is a fairly significant amount to be offered. So they're getting quite a bit of signage. I don't know the exact numbers of sign up for that, but that's a start. You know?
Where can people find out more about that? This is NRCS stands for?
National Resource and Conservation Service.
Okay.
And you'll need to contact your local office. So there's county offices that you can contact.
Okay, let's go to you wanted to say something, Tom, before we go to the next caller?
Nope. That's
she's just breathing heavily over here, giving me
just
a look.
Just the best place to go is to talk directly to those folks.
Yeah.
Okay, Zach is in Iowa City. Hi, Zach. Yep. Welcome to the program.
Hi, yes, I didn't hear the introduction. I have two things. One, I had read a while ago a really interesting practice of aerial seeding winter rye or winter wheat into soybean fields just before the leaves drop. And then the leaves drop off the soybean plants and cover the seed. And then that cover crop will come up then as soon as it can. I thought that was a really neat example. And then I just wanted to ask if you could give several examples of different specific plants and the advantages that they would have, uses that they would have.
Okay, let's address that. Thank you, Zach, calling from Iowa City.
Well, I can talk a little bit about the aerial seeding. Yes, we've been doing that for quite a while. It's one of those things that's been used for a while in different places, but that works very well. We've done it with winter rye, winter wheat, or oats, and the idea is to broadcast seed those into standing soybeans just at about the time the leaves turn yellow. And then the leaves fall on top of the seed, we get a rainfall, and they take off from there. So that does work very well and is a good way to go about it.
So the most common types of cover crops, can you list those quickly?
Well, the winter cereals that we talked about, also hairy vetch, which is a legume, has been used. Those are the ones that have been used most commonly in Iowa. Across the Midwest, or in systems where we have winter wheat or earlier bare ground during the summer, you can get into a whole range of things, what we call the brassicas, which are turnips, rape, radishes, any of the other forage legumes like red clover, alfalfa, any of those. And then there are some others like buckwheat, millet that some people have used, but they're more summer annuals. So there's a wide range of things. And it's just a matter of matching the planting window with the characteristics of the species.
Mm-hmm. And also being aware of what it is that you want that cover crop to do. I mean, is your biggest concern erosion? Is your biggest concern a nitrate balance? Is your concern that you need a second crop maybe? So there's a couple different things there. I need to comment back on the aerial seeding because I remember, Tom will probably get me for this, but I remember at the conference that there was a couple things that the making sure that that aerial seeding is set so that the distribution is even over the field, and there were a couple of examples of people having some rather disastrous experiences with that, and they thought it might be due to the fact that the seeding wasn't evenly distributed, and that's beyond me. But the other thing you noticed he did mention was, and then that rain comes and we get it. So we're back to farming again, right?
Right. Jim is joining us from Des Moines. Hi, Jim. Jim, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead. Our hour is finishing up. What is your comment or question?
Well, very shortly, I'm 70 years old, and I can remember back when my dad would plow the ground, and it was so beautiful and so black, and the blackbirds and the robins would come swooping down to make their meal. And then I went away for a few years, came back, and went out in the field, and that soil was like powder. And I was so sad to see that happening. Fully realizing that the Midwest feeds the world, but there's got to be some way. I'm really happy to hear that word crop rotation and cover crop come back into the conversation.
Nice. Thanks. Perspective, a nice long view from Jim in Des Moines. So what is his comment about the powdery versus the rich black soil have to do with cover crops, if anything?
Biological activity. Go ahead.
Yeah, biological activity, inputs and outputs of putting back into the soil carbon, the plant material, the organic matter. When you don't do that, it eventually...
The tillage breaks it down.
Yeah, over time, or decomposes over time. Mm-hmm.
And then you get the soil that should be on like a Clint Eastwood Western movie or something.
Puffing up as you go driving by in your three-wheeler, right?
So that soil you want to just go down and just take a big whiff of, right?
Right.
Now, Jerry, you spoke earlier about the precipitation in Iowa, changing weather patterns, and how cover crops also work well into this scenario as we look at climate change.
Oh, we need them. And I'm sure that all of us can remember it would just make you cry, some of the erosion that we saw with the big rains last spring. And what we're going to have to do to think about that is point of contact, that we need those living roots in the soil. And cover crops will be wonderful for that, because what they're going to do is help increase infiltration, hold that soil down there.
How are we doing generally in terms of soil erosion in the Midwest, in Iowa? Are we still losing a tremendous amount down the Mississippi?
Do you know the latest numbers, Tom? I don't know the latest numbers.
I don't know the latest numbers, but we're still losing ground, so to speak. it's not only a matter of losing it down the Mississippi, you know, it's losing it from one part of the field to the other. We've done some work in fields around Ames and shown that we're getting movement of soil from the hillier sections to areas that already have plenty of topsoil. So the end result is that we lose yield on those elevated parts of our field, and we put more soil where we don't need any more.
Okay, to wrap up, we have just a few seconds left. How do people find out more about the use of cover crops?
I would say two things. If you go to the Leopold Center website and look for cover crops resource page, there's a page there that has a number of things, and it also has a link to a survey. And if people have used or tried cover crops, we'd like them to fill out that survey and get it back. And it's being coordinated by Practical Farmers of Iowa. And the second place to go right now is the Midwest Cover Crops Council.
Okay, thank you.
Go to that website.
Thank you very much for joining us, Tom Casper and Jerry Neal. It's been a pleasure having you with us to talk about cover crops.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ben.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for the callers this hour. It's been a real pleasure. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.